You're listening to a Wheeler Centre podcast.
One of the great pleasures of reading a terrific writer is that you just come alive. You're engaged in it in ways that, you know, dull writers don't capture you in the same way.
With the recent passing of American writer, novelist, memoirist, and filmmaker Paul Auster, today on the Wheeler Centre podcast, we're reflecting on the influence of this literary giant. In this episode, the iconic author is in conversation with Corey Perkin in our Postcards from Abroad series, as they discuss his 2021 book, Burning Boy, The Life and Work of Stephen Crane.
Hello everyone, my name is Corey Perkin and it is my pleasure on behalf of the Wheeler Centre to welcome you here today to our discussion with Paul Auster, one of the luminaries of American literature. Today I join you from the land of the Kulin Nation and I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging and to the elders of all communities this conversation reaches. Paul, on behalf of our audience and everyone connected with the Wheeler Centre, I thank you for joining us today and I offer you my sincerest congratulations on your astounding new non-fiction work, Burning Boy, The Life and Work of Stephen Crane, which has just arrived in Australian bookstores. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much. I'm just curious, could you tell me what day it is in Australia and what time it is?
It is, we are recording this on a Wednesday and it is 10 past 9 in the morning. What about you?
Right here it is 10 past 7 in the evening. And it is, I believe it's Tuesday. It's Tuesday.
I imagine this time last year when you were locked down in New York for that terrible 6-week period, I imagine you were doing the edits, I guess, on Burning Boy.
Yes. In fact, I finished the text of the book. It's a strange thing. In February of 2020, meaning, the pandemic had started, but it hadn't hit the United States in any serious way at that point. It wasn't until early March that things got dicey in New York City. So I finished the book, and then for months afterwards, I was preoccupied with the book because I had to do the notes, for example. I'd never written a book of this sort, and I never had to do notes. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of notes, and I had to track down every source. And then there was an index that had to be done, which is a very laborious process. I've never been involved in that either. And not to speak of reading pass after pass of proofs. And when you're dealing with a book of so many pages, so many words, you know, there are mistakes. They're just errors. And I kept finding them up to the last second. I hope it's clean now. I'm not 100% sure. But I was amazed to see how even professional proofreaders and copy editors would miss things. And things that I had read 12 times before, suddenly I see the mistake. You know, three O's in a word instead of two. Room, you know, with three O's, that kind of thing. It just, your eye goes right over it. You don't want to see it. You're anticipating what the correct spelling is, and you substitute that for what's actually on the page.
It's been a mammoth effort for you. I read in an interview that you actually recorded it in 2017. You told the interviewer, this was October 2017, you said, I'm still bubbling with ideas, but I'm working on a kind of biographical critical thing about an American writer I care about, and I think I'm going to write a little book about that. Your little book has become 800 pages of brilliance, of incredible research, of beautiful storytelling, wise analysis and passion. Your passion for the work of writer, poet and journalist Stephen Crane, who died in 1900 at just 28 years of age, And Paul, I must say, every page is a joy to read. This is what happens, I suppose, when one of America's finest writers decides to absorb themselves for 3 years in the life of another fine American writer. I just wondered what it was about the short but extraordinary life and that raw talent of Stephen Crane that lured you in the first place.
Well, thank you for all the nice comments about the book. You have no idea how it comforts me to hear you say that. Here's the thing. I had finished writing that other long book that I've written in my life, 4321, a novel of about the same length as this, even longer than this book on Crane, actually. And I was exhausted. I mean, wiped out. And I knew that it was going to be quite a while before I could write anything at all. I decided that I would spend my time, this pause period, which I hadn't really ever done for such a protracted length of time between books, reading. I wanted to catch up on the books that I'd always meant to read and had not read, and now I was reading them. And among the people I wanted to go back to was Stephen Crane. I had read a number of his works when I was young, and I mean very young, 15, 16 years old, I had read Crane, who at the time when I was in high school was required reading in English classes. The Red Badge of Courage was something that all adolescents in America read. But that's not the case anymore. I asked my daughter, who was 30 when I was starting the book, if she had read it in high school. No, she hadn't. I asked one by one all the friends of hers that I crossed paths with in the months to follow, and none of them had read it. There may be 20 or 25 young people from all parts of the United States. No one had read Crane, and most of them had never heard of Crane. Then when I started talking to friends of mine not from the United States, and I'm talking about writer friends, not just, you know, people you meet in a cafe, but professional writers. In Europe, only one of my friends had ever heard or read Crane, a friend in France. And even in England, surprisingly, very few people had read or heard of Crane. And this was so surprising to me. I thought, I need to write something about him, because as I got back into his work, I understood how great it is. And I hadn't truly understood that when I was a boy. And I hadn't read enough, you know, to form a full judgment. So I had a book. It was an anthology of Crane's work, about 500 pages worth. And I read, the first thing that I read was a novella called The Monster, which made such a strong impression on me that I was motivated to read everything else in that collection. And having absorbed all of this, which the word is overwhelmed by how good it was, I graduated to the next biggest book, this Library of America edition, 1,400 pages, read all of that, and was still amazed, and then went out and bought the collected works of Stephen Crane in all 10 volumes, over 3,000 tightly printed pages of how can anyone dead at 28 have written 3,000 pages at 28? Doesn't seem possible, but he did.
Was it easy to find that? Was it easy to find that group those editions?
Well, the Library of America. I don't know if you know what it is. It's do you know the Pléiade editions in France? These are very beautiful books of classic French writers. You know, on Bible paper, India paper, beautifully put together. And I don't know, about 30 years ago, Americans got the idea that they would do their equivalent, which is called the Library of America. So Crane is in one of those volumes. He was, I tell you, one of the first 15 or 20 that they did, actually. And now there are hundreds of books. So those were easy. The collected, I had to order, you know, online, but I got hold of it, and it's still in print. These were books that were published in the 70s, the 10 volumes. And so I thought, yes, I would write this short book of appreciation to just try to get people interested in reading Crane again. And then, of course, having read all the work, I got interested in his life and started reading everything I could get my hands on about his biography. And it's such an interesting life, such a crazy life, so filled with adventures and misadventures and all kinds of harrowing situations that he was in. I mean, among them, you know, surviving a shipwreck off the coast of Florida on his way to Cuba to report on the Cuban Revolution against the Spanish. You know, and then later going into the Spanish-American War and reporting from Cuba and under heavy fire there as well of bullets, not the threat of drowning, but just being shot up into little pieces. And many other harrowing tales. And it was so interesting that the little book became a big book, because I realized that I didn't want to just tell the story of his life, nor did I just want to write a critical book about his writings, but I wanted to do both and reintroduce him to the reading public. And so I went on the assumption that my reader knows nothing about Crane. On the other hand, I also assumed that anybody who would be interested in reading this book is a literate person, someone interested in writers and literature and makes a habit of reading. So it's not for 10-year-olds, this book. It's for sophisticated people, but those who do not necessarily know much about the subject I'm writing about.
Well, it's for the curious as well. You know, Paul, most Australian readers, including myself, are unfamiliar with Crane's work. And I had a bookshop for 12 years. And although I'd heard of The Red Badge of Courage, I guess we could say that's probably his best known work, but I'd never read it.
Yes.
And we've known even less about this gifted author who died in 1900 at such an appallingly young age. And I love the way you have incorporated in your book so many passages of Crane's writing, both fiction and nonfiction, and also newspaper reports and magazine reports that he wrote during his journalism phases. But if I may quote you back to yourself, I love this explanation about how you've tackled this project. You say, "What I have wanted to do is communicate something about the experience of reading Crane and how it feels to encounter his work for the first time, a raw and direct response to what is sitting in front of us on the page, the words themselves, and thoughts and images those words provoke in us as we move from one sentence to the next. A writer's approach, if you will, the nuts and bolts of how it is done, and because I have assumed my readers have never read a word of Crane, I have quoted many passages at length in order to give them a full sampling of what he could do and how he went about doing it in each specific work." And so for any student of literature, anyone who loves books, anybody who loves fiction and nonfiction, you've given us such a gift. You've taken our hand and you've walked us through just an extraordinary journey. So we should all be indebted to you, Paul.
Well, I felt that I was in conversation with my reader and trying to share my enthusiasms. And I had to restrain myself. I said, but you know, okay, look at this sentence and see how this one moves into the next and the effect that this has. I think, you know, what I should say about Crane, again, because I assume the people listening or watching this have not read him. What Crane did, why he's important and why I consider him to be the first modernist in American literature, the man who opened the door onto the 20th century, the one who led the way to such writers as Hemingway and Fitzgerald and numerous others, is that He got rid of the conventions of the 19th century novel. He just stripped them. He kicked them out. All those big, fat novels that we love so much by Tolstoy and Balzac and Dickens, filled with countless details and descriptions of things, wonderful as this is. I mean, I'm not diminishing this at all. But I at one point compared that, you can't, because Crane strips all that out and only deals with what is essential. So in every one of his narratives, whether it's a short story, a novella, or a novel, and none of his novels is long. He was a writer of rather compact short forms. There's missing information. The things that, you know, you think any novelist or story writer would tell you, you don't get to know. Most dramatically, in The Red Badge of Courage, which is set during the American Civil War. A war, by the way, we have to emphasize, Crane never saw, because it ended 6 years before he was born. So everything he knew about the Civil War, he had either learned through reading, but most important, he talked and talked and talked to the veterans who lived in his town, who had experienced battles in the Civil War. And he probably knew more than anybody his age about what it felt like to be a soldier during that brutal war, which was the first industrialized war in human history. And it was a brutal business that lasted for 4 years. Okay, the story of The Red Badge of Courage is about a young man who enlists. We never know his exact age, but I would assume he's 16, perhaps 17. 18 at the very limit, but 17 seems to be about right. Crane never gives the name of the war. He never gives the causes of the war. He never mentions the word slavery. He never mentions the name Abraham Lincoln. You don't know the name of a single general, and you don't know the name of a single battle. All right? So already this is revolutionary in, going against everything that people assumed was necessary in a novel. And what he does, he takes you inside the mind of this adolescent and tracks it very closely because the boy is afraid and he runs. He turns tail and runs in his first battle. And the great gymnastics, mental and emotional gymnastics that this kid goes through to justify what he was doing, and the shame he feels when others are looking at him, and then the self-glorification he goes through when he's alone. I mean, it's just absolutely psychologically so spot on. But then the other great strength of Crane, and which makes him so exceptional, I think, is the acuity of his perceptions. I don't know what it was, something about his genetic, biological makeup. He was humming. I feel that he was a kind of electrified person. And he could see things that most of us don't notice. And, he could describe anything perfectly, but with a few deft strokes. It's Cézanne, you know, with the palette brush. It's not a Renaissance painting. It's rough and fast, but also extraordinarily vivid. And
Paul, he could feel things as well. I mean, the emotions that of someone so young. He can obviously put himself in the head of that 16 or 17 year old boy who goes off to war, but his capacity for empathy and emotional intelligence is vast.
You know why? Because his credo as a writer was he never judged anybody. He just took reality as it was. And again, in America at that time, this genteel late 19th century attitude that writers had, they were always moralizing. They always wanted to find some social value or religious value in what they were writing. And Crane just wanted to tell what it was really happening out in the world. And so this was revolutionary. But, you know, this great perceptual capacity combined with an ability to transform this into language, into words on the page. Because, okay, assuming there are acutely aware people who can see these things, they can't express them very well often. But he has that ability. And some of his sentences are so extraordinary that, you know, you gasp. And even in, you know, insignificant short pieces, there's a little piece when he's in Cuba during the war, and he's just trying to explain how hot it was, but in one sentence. And, you know, it's summer. It's 100 degrees Fahrenheit in Cuba. And he says, the sky was bare and blue and hurt like brass. Now, you think, what does that mean? Does brass actually hurt you? And you have to think about it for a second. But if you imagine a brass tray sitting out in the hot sun of the Cuban summer, and you put your hand on that brass, it would hurt. And suddenly, you know, you have a tactile sense of what he's saying. Or another sentence that I point out in the book is I loved it. I found it so astonishing. I don't think any writer ever had come up with a thing like this. It was also in Cuba. It was an article he wrote. And he wrote, the woman's boatman had a face like a floor. Now, what does that mean? Well, what he means is it was blank because he didn't want that woman in his boat anymore. He wanted to take her back to the shore and get another customer. And she's sobbing her heart out as her lover is departing from the defeated Spanish army, going back to Spain. And he's contrasting her being overcome with these sorrowful, painful emotions and the blankness of the boatman, a face like a floor. But the work is filled with this kind of thing, and you have to, you know, pay attention. It's just, he makes you alert. And I think that's one of the great pleasures of reading a terrific writer, is that you just come alive. You're engaged in it in ways that, you know, dull writers don't capture you in the same way.
Well, as you're saying that, I'm thinking of the time back in the late 1980s, I guess it was, when I was first introduced to your novels, firstly, and then later your nonfiction work. And it is always so exciting and fresh to read, and the New York trilogy and Music of Chance, and The Guardian describes you still as one of America's most groundbreaking novelists. And that's certainly how I felt when I was first introduced to your writing. And I was thinking about this as you were talking, and that one of the descriptions that you give of Stephen Crane, and in fact herein lies the title to your book, you say, a burning boy of rare precociousness who is blocked from entering the fullness of adulthood. He is America's answer to Keats and Shelley, to Schubert and Mozart, and if he continues to live on as they do, it is because his work has never grown old. 120 years after his death, Stephen Crane continues to burn. And that strikes me as a very generous comment, Paul, and filled with deep understanding of what it's like to be a shooting star across, you know, the literary world's horizon. And I think that's probably what I love about this 800-page epic that you've written. It's from you, a writer. You understand.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. I have to tell you that I really get bored with academic literary criticism. I can't read it. I certainly didn't want to approach his text that way. As you read the explanation, which comes at the end of the book in the acknowledgments. So it was a more direct approach, and I didn't do a lot of research. I mean, I read some essays that people had written. I was, you know, informed, but none of it had any great impact on me. On the other hand, where I really had to do the research was in the life. And this is a fascinating thing because the first biography of Crane was written in 1923. And it was written by a writer who wrote novels, and he did nonfiction as well, someone named Thomas Beer, spelled like the drink, Beer. And Beer tried to dig up facts about Crane. He had a lot of trouble. And so being an inventive, rather strange person, he made up about half the book. He just invented incidents that had never happened. He invented people who had never existed. He had those non-existent people write letters that had never been written. And for about 30 years, that was the one biography of Crane. So all these misapprehensions spread about who he was. And it's taken decades and decades for subsequent scholars to clear up all these errors and try to get to the, you know, the truth of who he was. I think, you know, they've gotten there to a large degree, and I followed some of the most important of these scholars. But still there are blanks and things that will never be known, even in that short life. So, suddenly, you know, there are 2 or 3 months and no one knows where he was, what he was doing. Or, you know, did he actually propose a second time to the woman he fell in love with when he was young? Did he go back and propose or not? No one can really say. There are these mysteries that have no answers. Well, you know, and I just, of course, say we won't know, or we don't know, or we can't say. And I would speculate about what might have happened, but always in a provisional way. I think, you know, it was such an interesting life because Crane was the youngest of 14 children, if you can believe it. It's hard to imagine families of 14 today. 9 surviving children. His father was a Methodist minister. His mother was a devout Methodist, anti-tolerance. She was for prohibiting alcohol.
But she had a very smart mind, Paul. She was very smart.
Oh, no, they were both. The mother was smart and the father was smart too, but they were really religious. Crane loved his parents. His father died when he was 8. His father wrote books about, you know, the evils of dancing, you know, things like this. But he was apparently a very warm-hearted, humorous man and very progressive politically, who spoke out against slavery long before the Civil War. And actually, after the war, Crane's parents opened up 2 schools for black residents of the town. There was a school for men, a school for women and children, and they were really doing what they could. These were good people. But Crane rebelled against the religious part of all this. And he really became, if not an outspoken critic of Methodism and Christianity, a deep non-believer, someone in a kind of rage against the pompous pieties of these certainties of religious conviction. He's a man at home with doubts, which is another thing that makes him so modern. I mean, at times I think he's a forerunner of Camus, and Crane's position finally turns out into what we would call today existentialist, but before it had that name. So he wasn't much of a student. He was a terrific athlete. He was a great baseball player, but he only went to one year of university, but he went to 2 colleges in the same year. He quit the first one. Then his mother kind of pushed him into going to another one, where he mostly goofed off.
To become an engineer, Paul, of all things. No offense to the engineers who are listening, but.
No, but you see, his brother, Crane was so much younger than all of them that, you know, his older siblings were, you know, 17, 18, 19 years older than he was. So it was like, so one of the brothers was like a, I don't know, a substitute father. And he was the one respectable person in the family. He was a lawyer and a businessman. And the family had some stocks in coal mines. And so the brother thought it would be a good idea for the little one to go and become an engineer because he would know about these things. And Crane had no aptitude and no interest in this. So he flunked most of his classes. That was at Lafayette College. Then he quit, and his mother persuaded him to go to Syracuse, which his great uncle had helped found. It was originally a Methodist school. So we went there, but he mostly just played on the baseball team and read a lot of books and started writing and quit after 1 year. But he had the advantage. One of the brothers, another one, worked as a newspaper man in Asbury Park, New Jersey, where the family eventually moved, and when Crane was about 12. And
this is about... This is about what year? About 1890?
This was late 1880s. When Crane, you know, he was born in 71. So in the late 1880s, he started working for this brother who had a news agency. And Asbury Park then was the summer mecca of holiday for that part of the United States. It's right on the Atlantic Ocean. It's very beautiful. There was a boardwalk there, and the thing was, I think there were something like 600,000 people who either spent the summer or the weekends in Asbury Park during the course of the summer season. And Crane was writing little squibs for the newspaper about all the social events going on. And I like imagining this 16-year-old boy pedaling around on his bicycle, you know, and getting little scoops for his brother, Townley, who was such a hardworking reporter. They called him the shore fiend, the brother. And that's where Crane learned how to write, is doing these little things. And some of them, even when he's 17 or 18, they're hilariously funny, really, really terrific fun to read. And and then he got more and more serious about it all. But it took him a while, but not that long, because, of course, he really only had a good 8 years as a writer.
He, you include a rather interesting quote for me as a journalist too, Paul. I find this, it's always about simple is best. In 1892, he tells a fellow reporter, Arthur Oliver, forget what you think about it until, because Arthur was having trouble writing his news stories and his feature stories. And he says, forget what you think about it and tell how you feel about it. Make the other fellow realize you are just as human as he is. That's the big secret of storytelling. Away with the literary cads and canons. Be yourself.
Yeah.
This is Stephen Crane. At what age is
he's
he?
20,
18 or 19?
20. 20. He's 20. Yeah. He knew. He knew. Yeah.
He knew.
And he was always getting into trouble. One of the articles he wrote in that summer of 1892 had a big effect on the presidential campaign. And he got fired from the newspaper. And, you know, it was one thing after another. The other thing, you know, to know about Crane is his great sense of adventure. After The Red Badge of Courage came out, but only in the serialized version, he had finished the book, but it hadn't. He wasn't famous yet. But one of the newspaper syndicates sent him out west and to Mexico. And for 4 months, he just wandered around, sending out back dispatches. He was in Nebraska. He was in Texas. He was in Arkansas. And then he was down in Mexico having God knows what crazy adventures there. And that produced a flood of work because there were later short stories about all of those places that are some of the best things he did. And then, of course,
Paul, I just have to say one of the highlights of that you've brought to our attention through your book is it's you know, a brief moment in this extraordinary traveling career when he is in Pennsylvania and he travels down the coal mines, and what he sees, the conditions and the men that he meets, really galvanizes him. Quite politically, in a way, doesn't it? He really starts a fight for the worker.
Yes, yes. No, he was always on the side of the underdog. He wasn't overtly political. You know, he wasn't part of a party or anything, but he had his convictions. I think there was something so hard in him, you know, so honest. You know, he would look and he would see the flaws in every argument. And so he wasn't someone who would embrace this philosophy or that philosophy. He was a skeptic. So he knew the abominations of capitalism. I mean, he was, you know, appalled by what the, you know, the robber barons were doing to the country. But at the same time, even though he explored the urban poor, he wrote about the urban poor, he knew the urban poor, and he lived among them, he didn't idealize these people. A lot of them were, you know, drunken, crazy, violent, destroyed human beings. So, you know, it's just, he's always just telling you what's actually happening. He's not creating some veil of ideology between his perceptions and, you know, what he would like to be. It's fascinating. Then, so he covered two wars. He was in Greece covering the Greco-Turkish War, which, to tell you the truth, I never knew there was such a war in 1897. It lasted for 1 month. But by then he was living with a woman, Cora, the Cora. I think any feminist interested in womanhood of this period should look at the chapters in my book about Cora, who I find one of the most remarkable women of the time. She was a free spirit.
Can I just ask you there, which surname are you using for Cora? Because she was a woman of many surnames. Do you
absolutely
use Taylor? Which
I
one
mean,
to
so,
call her?
Well, and in the very last page of the book, I give all of them. Let's see if I can remember them all. Well, she was born Koa Howarth, and then she married a man named Murphy, and then she divorced this man, and she married another man named Stuart. And then Stuart wouldn't divorce her, so she and Crane could never marry. But they lived as Mr. and Mrs. Crane when they moved to England after being in Greece together, because the English didn't care the way the Americans cared then. And then after Crane's death, she married somebody else again. So she was Howarth, Murphy, Stewart, Crane, McNeil. And she only lived to 45. When Crane met her, he was on the way to Cuba. He was stuck in Jacksonville waiting for the ship, Jacksonville, Florida. And Cora, at that time, independent, was running something close to a brothel. It was like a nightclub brothel without prostitutes living on the premises, but gentlemen could come with their lady friends and use the rooms upstairs. And Crane and the other journalists would hang out there. And she fell madly in love with him because she was a great reader. She was very, very intelligent and a good writer and a deep reader. And she loved Crane's work. She had read it before they met. And she went, as Crane said, heels over head. I mean, she just fell for him. She called him, Crane was on the small side, 5'7", 125 pounds. And she called him her mouse, my mouse. But she also called him my shining star, and then later when they were living in England, she called him the Duke. And It was an extraordinary alliance between the two. And she was with him on the day he died. And so for the last 3.5 years of his life, they were together. And so they moved to England to get away from Crane's overzealous religious relatives and lived as Mr. and Mrs. Crane. And there, I mean, it's just so fascinating. Crane's closest friend was Joseph Conrad. These two were brothers. And Henry James was living down the road, who adored Crane, and he thought this is the future of American writing. And H.G. Wells was nearby, another friend, Ford Madox Ford. It's quite extraordinary, this whole group that he knew in the last period of his life, and how much they really loved him.
Apart from his prodigious talent, Paul, which would have, I'm sure, impressed and attracted that cohort, but you're also talking about Cora's attraction to him. And in the later photos, he does kind of develop into a handsome man, and you can only imagine what he would have been like in his 40s or 50s. I think he would have been very attractive to look at. But do you sense that he had a personal charisma or a physical charisma about him?
Yes, and I think a lot of people talk about this, and that's why, you know, I quote friends of his who wrote about him after his death and the particular attraction. There was one friend that was at Syracuse with him, Fred Lawrence, who became a medical doctor. And he and Crane were, you know, the best of friends. And he said Crane had this force in a group. He didn't say much. He was quiet. But somehow he was directing the train of conversation, he said, and the train of thought. And Crane didn't laugh a lot, but he smiled. He had all kinds of different smiles to respond to things. And I think people, he said it was Crane the man that people were so attracted to, not Crane the writer, that he held the center of attention without doing anything. There was something magical about him. He had some magnetism. And I think nearly everyone who liked him felt that. And there were a lot of people who liked him.
I was also interested. He and Cora were living in England, as you say, you know, on and off during the late 1890s, back forward a bit. And I can't see that he ever wrote about England. Yet everywhere he travels, you know, through the States, Cuba, Greece, you know, he's writing madly. He's inspired by events or people around him or scenery. Yet in England, he doesn't write about the place. He writes, but he doesn't write anything about it.
Right. Well, I mentioned this. The last novel, which was unfinished, which I don't really go into, I just didn't have time to. It's called The O'Ruddy, and it was a book he did to try to make some money, but it's very good. It's a kind of swashbuckler, and it takes place in the 18th century, and it's an Irishman who goes to England. So that book does take place in England, but not the contemporary England he was living in. And I feel that for him, going to England was, I think he felt comfortable there. I don't think he disliked it at all. But it didn't inspire him, as you say. But I think it was a place calm enough then for him to be able to reflect on other places. And so it was useful in that way as a kind of neutral ground. You know, I talk about places and different writers, you know, Faulkner staying in Mississippi, you know, to write about Mississippi. Joyce writing about Dublin, living everywhere but Dublin, you know, Trieste and Zurich and Paris. You know, Kafka never leaving Europe, but, you know, writing his first book, America, you know, an imaginary America, you know, with the Nature Theater of Oklahoma in the last chapter. So as I tried to say, for a writer, even the real places that you've lived in, when you start to write about them in fiction, they become imaginary. And I have this feeling, you know, I've made some films in my long life now and directed some films, and some of them, you know, have been shot in New York. And I have this strange feeling that when I am in a taxi going past a spot where, say, 20 years ago, we filmed a scene. And so during the space of those days, filming on that corner, say, that place, the real place, became an imaginary place in the story I had written. And so I go past, say, West 25th Street in New York, and it's layered. It's layered for me. Yeah, it's West 25th Street, but it's also, you know, scene 56 from the movie I directed. And I see the actors standing on the corner, and all the crew with the lights and the cameras and the microphones, and it's fascinating. This idea of place, how we carry around it in us, and if you live in one place long enough, it's almost as if it's archaeological. It has layers of different periods in your life. And I can walk down 57th Street, and you know, I can remember the role of 57th Street when I was 9 years old, but also 26 years old, and also 52 years old, and they're all different. It's the same place. I'm sure you have this in Melbourne, right?
Well, you do, and also, I mean, I think Crane and great writers like yourself are able to imagine places perhaps you've never been as well, which he clearly does. With a lot of his work.
Yes.
But you call yourself a Jersey man, and Stephen Crane spent time in Jersey. And I was interested in the book to read your observations of him writing about this area that was kind of familiar, although decades later, but familiar to you both. And I wonder, Paul, with all of this forensic study of Stephen Crane's life and work, has it impacted on your writing now? Has it influenced you? Is it influencing you?
I'm too old to change. Nobody's influencing me now. It's just far too late. But you see, the funny thing is, yes, we were born in the same city of Newark, New Jersey. But so what? That has no connection to why I wrote the book. And I think I'm so attracted to Crane's writing precisely because it's so unlike the way I write. My work is essentially storytelling, narrative, pure narrative, very little description in my work, actually, not that much dialogue either, both of which Crane excelled at. But more important, he had a kind of lapidary style. He wrote in little fragments, and he didn't write these ongoing narratives that I've done throughout my writing life. But I think it's precisely what's so fresh about it for me, because to see someone do this so well is really impressive. And it reminds me of the fact that I remember, you talk about writers influencing you. When I was a young person in my 20s, writing poems and translating poems, writing essays, trying to write fiction as well, but not successfully, very unhappy with the results. I knew quite a few older writers also, especially during the years I was living in Paris. Some very famous writers, even, you know, Samuel Beckett, I knew him, and we would get together. He was extremely nice to me. But I noticed among, you know, these older writers, when I would talk about a new writer that I had read, I said, you know, have you read so-and-so? And they say, no, I haven't. And I was always puzzled, why aren't these older writers more curious about what's going on? To me, it's so exciting. And then I got to be old myself, and I realized that I don't keep up either anymore. And it's because I think when you're young and you're still finding yourself, you really are very receptive to the influences that come in from outside you, because you're in gestation, so to speak. Once you get past a certain point in your trajectory as a writer, yes, of course you keep changing, but these are inner changes, self-propelled inner changes. There is nothing in the world that I could open up and read now and say, damn it, I've been wrong all my life. I should have been writing like this. It's just too late. I'm set in my ways in such a way that I hope I'm continually reinventing myself. But at the same time, these exciting influences and discoveries are for the young, and the old farts like me just, we're pushing on in this thing we've found and keep going to the end.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying when we consider that Stephen Crane died so tragically young, 28, tuberculosis, and I think probably complications from the cholera that he picked up in Cuba.
Well, malaria.
And a very weakened body, and died in England and was brought home to America to be buried with his family.
Germany.
Oh, sorry, he died in Remember? Germany. He did too. My apologies.
They took him to the Black Forest, the sanatorium.
How cruel was that? He was in no position to be traveling. It was so cruel. It does make me think about the impact. He's had an impact, of course, on the American literary canon, but how much more significant it could have been.
Well, you never know. It's quite possible that Crane, who is his great flaw as a human being, was his inability to hold on to money. So he was always in debt. And a lot of the things he wrote were to make money. Fortunately, the greater percentage of them are very good as well. But who knows if he wouldn't have gotten tired and burned out a little bit and started cranking things out without really believing in it. I don't think so. But he was so pressed all the time that he never had any breathing room. But I think he created this situation for himself because I believe he knew early on that he was going to die young. And so he wanted to push himself as hard as he could, experience as much as he could, and not waste any time. And risking things was much more exciting than sitting around in his slippers smoking a pipe. That was not the life he wanted. And he gambled a lot. He loved to play poker. And he just as soon sleep on a hard dirt out in the woods than in a soft bed. He just didn't care about any of these things. So he burned out. I mean, the title has many, many ramifications for me. I think he burned out. He was extinguished by his own, the fire inside of him, which was a limited one because of his health conditions.
Well, because of your wonderful and extraordinary book, Paul, Stephen Crane is now burning bright in front of all of us. And I wish you every success with this book. It's you were asked in an interview when you turned 70, which was only a minute ago, I might add, and you said, "My body is not as spry and as strong as it used to be, but having come to what I always thought as a young person as an old age, I feel my days are dwindling no matter what. And because there are fewer days left, I seem to be taking greater pleasure in being alive." And you said, "I think I feel happier than I ever have felt in my life." Well, I hope Stephen Crane and the success surrounding him brings you lots more happiness, Paul.
Well, thank you so much. You've been so gracious and kind and astute. So I'm very happy that we had this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. And the Wheeler Center and all of our staff and all of our audience and everybody connected with our Center for Books, Writing and Ideas, thank you most sincerely for your time. And I can just remind audiences that if you would like to purchase a copy of Paul's book, A Burning Boy, The Life and Work of Stephen Crane, our partnering bookshop is Hill of Content here in Melbourne, CBD. Poor old Hill of Content suffered a lot of weeks in lockdown, so get behind them, give them a call and buy a copy of Paul's most wonderful book. Paul, thank you again very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Corrie Perkin in conversation with Paul Auster. It was originally released as a digital event as part of the Wheeler Centre's Postcards from Abroad series on Wednesday, the 3rd of November, 2021. The Wheeler Centre podcast is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. You can listen to more podcasts or explore videos, news, and our full calendar of events at wheelercentre.com.